This is Talk Is Cheap on KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peace Works Independent Community Radio. All right, this is part one of the Environmental Film Festival from October of 2025. Part one of the Brings Recycling Q&A after the film on recycling. So, and the talk is about recycling and the new recycling facility, the new controversial recycling facility that we are trying to get in Eugene that will divert things from the, using robotics, it will divert material from the landfill to recycling. And so you'll hear about the controversies on that. And this is part one. Part two will be next week. You'll hear Anna, who is the head of the Environmental Film Festival, the organizer. And Beth is from Brings Recycling, and the others will be introduced by Beth. For a few minutes here, they're talking about Venezuela, about on the news about that it's because of fentanyl that we're sending ships to a potential war with Venezuela. I just want to say that keep in mind Venezuela is where all the oil is in South America. So it's really about oil. This is yet again an oil war, which is all the wars of the 20th century and basically the 21st century too are really about oil. Israel is more about weapons sales because we give Israel $8 billion a year and most of that is spent on weapons, but that's just an aside. So I just want to point out that the war, the potential war in Venezuela is basically about oil, and that's why that we're trying to put a dictator more conducive, that is more a person who is more conducive, a leader who is more conducive to corporate resource extraction is what this is all about. No matter what even NPR tells you, and I hope you will support NPR in their loss of funding, but this is an example of what they do, and they tell you things, first of all, after it's too late to do anything about it. They do report things on the left, but it's too late to do it once you hear about it. And also, they take it out of the context of corporate U.S. foreign economic policy and corporate resource extraction, as I've said many times on this show. So thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Support independent media. And check out the open mics, the comedy open mics around town. You might see me at the comedy open mics around town. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Support independent media.
I'll ask some questions first because I like that. Oh, also, I'm supposed to say an announcement. I get kind of excited up here and I forget the things I'm supposed to say. So before everyone leaves, aside from these wonderful questions we're going to ask, I am supposed to tell you to sign the postcards at the table in the front. To the elected officials asking them to support the Clean Lane Resource Recovery Facility. So that's a facility that we were talking about today, but we need public push, that's what we'll say. So thanks for coming. So I guess I'll start with the basic, which is kind of, how did you get into, I'll ask David and Melissa, how did you get into this film? There's architecture going on, there's like innovative solutions, there's kind of, there's this resource. How did a film come about in your project?
Well, so we have kind of a unique architecture practice, and we were having to explain ourselves all the time about what we were doing and trying to share what we were doing with other people. And so a friend of a friend knew this filmmaker, and we started talking. He's like, well, I could just make a little film and you could show it to people, and then they would understand what you're doing because it's not common. So, okay, that sounds good. That's easy. So I do apologize. We tried to cast a better lead person, but Brad Pitt wasn't available. So we started to make this little film, and it was just meant to be a couple minutes long. And then, you know, life happens, things happen in the world, and things change. And the filmmaker who ended up becoming an Emmy award-winning filmmaker, Stefan, who's amazing, he said, "Hey, I know we were supposed to do this little thing for you, but I'd really like to do something else now after we see what's happened to our community and how you guys are helping out." So he kind of focused on one little thing that we were doing and started to share that. And before we knew it, that's what we got. And it's actually the first time I watched the whole film. So I hate seeing myself on the film. But it was sort of an accident in a way. I mean, it was intentional in the beginning, but for a completely different purpose. And at the end of the day, every time that I see some of that footage, it becomes real emotional for me. And it makes me want, I'm like, what am I doing here? I should be doing something. So, that's kind of how it happened.
These passion projects always take longer than you think, or last longer, or get bigger. On your side of this, there's a lot of like green architecture here, and there's a lot of kind of push for that, and I love that. And also about Eugene, here's the commonality. It's also a make it myself community. It's like, it's a hippie place that has a lot of wonderful aspects, but there's a big kind of community of make it myselfers here, but I'm wondering what is that like in your community, and what led you to do a film? Yeah, because it's exciting and cute for the kids.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's also very emotional for me to see Make It Myself, but probably in different ways. So Make It Myself is by the band Ants on a Log, who I've collaborated with as performer. We've made music together. We've made shows together. And Make It Myself is also the title song of their latest album. And so they wanted to make a video with it and approached me to collaborate. And the fun challenge was, let's make this video and let's not buy anything for it. So with having like a very strong aesthetic in mind and knowing like what the vision was, and then sourcing all of the materials for it and going to friends and neighbors and community and seeing what we could pull in, literally going to people's house and pulling art off the refrigerator and going, oh, this is the perfect color scheme for this video. Can I borrow this? Doing that, and the person who's behind the camera, it's their kids in the film too. So like, they made those kids themselves. So it all came together really well. And Julie is one of the main people from Ants on a Log band, also edited and produced the video and the album. So it's all like very hands-on. We really did make it ourselves. And it was a really fun challenge. And something I love about Ants on a Log is that they don't just make music about these things. They really live these principles and encourage me to do better. Like whenever I go and visit them, and they're really doing all the things. They're really composting. They're writing songs about composting. And then they're coming up with family-friendly events around composting, you know. So they're really doing it in all the areas, which I love to see and like encourages me to do more on my part too.
That's cool. Being about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool. I like this festival. Well, I made it up, so I like that for that reason. But that be about it. Oh, some people might call it integration, but be about it component, like holding true to the inspiration and being able to do it and being able to live it and being able to like learn, enhance experiential. I love the, thank you guys for being here. We'll give them another round of applause because I always like being able to have that conversation and that dialogue about the real world of it. And so with that, I want to start taking not my questions. I could ask them all night, but do you have a question?
Take the microphone around to
people. Oh yeah, I can take the microphone. How do we want to do it? I know we have questions. That's what I thought.
Okay. Well, I just want to hear, how is Lahaina doing, and how many units did you make for them?
Things are moving forward. I think that for me, one of the things that I learned very early on was that after a disaster like that, at 5 years, you're at about 25% rebuild.
Wow.
So Ohanaho Village, which you saw, is completely self-funded by Family Life Center, which is the local homeless shelter that we've been partnering with for years. And so that's a partnership that we've already had. Right now in Ohanaho Village, we have over 200 individuals that are fire survivors that are living there rent-free and carbon-free. All electricity is off-grid, so which is amazing. And so far, I think we've donated about 24 house plans for people to use free of charge. And then we've held workshops for rebuilding as well. And right now we're in the middle of hosting an affordable housing competition with the County of Maui. So through that, we're going to, that's going to be coming out in December, January. It's going to be an international competition where the County of Maui will walk away with hopefully about 25 sets of plans from all over the world for people to use for free for affordable housing for local families. So slowly, but things are moving and people are determined and it's going to happen, but it just takes longer than you want.
I have a question about that. So with your film now highlighting this work, have you noticed any shifts in other communities following this model? Like, do you feel that it's kind of made some waves yet?
Well, immediately after the fires in Los Angeles, I was asked to speak in Washington, D.C., and we have done some lobbying to our legislators and our government there for help. And I was speaking there, and I got calls immediately after the fires from other architects in Los Angeles, and they said, hey, would you mind talking to a few of us about what you've been through? We saw you speak in Los Angeles, and because of what you talked about, we became SAP certified, which right after the fires, American Institute of Architects, which I was the president of our local chapter, trained a handful of us to go around and do safety assessments on all of the properties that were burned. So we went and documented all 2,800 properties, whether they were completely destroyed or partially destroyed. And so that was really touching. And so I was like, of course, you know, I'm happy to share. I said, I don't know a lot. All I know is my experience, but I'm happy to share that. And they said, great, well, let's do it next week. And before I knew it, they said, we have 350 people that want to be on the call.
Wow.
And so I said, well, hang on, that's a little bit out of my realm. So let me bring in other people. And so, so we've just been trying to offer our experience. Every place is different. And through that, I've made some good friends and hopefully been able to share things that help other people. But, you know, it's happening in other places and it's going to continue to happen in other places. And we need to continue to, like, build these skill sets and build the community that helps one another. So.
I'm gonna get to you, but I have the same question of the film of how. Where have you screened this film besides here, and have you noticed kind of inspiration and kiddos or moms? I know sometimes when you inspire kids, it can be hard on moms because they don't have time.
That's so funny. This is only the second time I've attended a screening, but it has been screening for the past few years. I live in Brooklyn, New York, so I was really happy to go see it at the BAM Children's Film Festival this past year. And just the other day, my sister, who is a new kindergarten teacher and has two kids of her own, told me, we were talking about me coming here, and she said, I'm so happy more people are seeing the film. I think about it often, and when she was outfitting her classroom, of course, there's the whole teacher budget thing, but she was like, no, I can make it myself. Like, what do I already have? What can I use from here? And I went to visit her classroom, and it's so precious. And, like, her kids came and helped make, like, bulletins, and it's perfect. So I love that. And today at the airport on my way here, there was a family who had a restless 3-year-old. And they were telling her, oh, just sit down, be quiet, look at your iPad, go on your iPad. Mm-hmm. And she wanted to move her body. And I also wanted to move my body. I'd been in the airport for a long time. And I asked, is it okay if I show her a book I have? And it's a book that I made myself. And I said, look, I made this book myself. And we looked at the book. It's about, it has the alphabet. And we practiced letters. And I could see the grandmother go from feeling like kind of like embarrassed or judged. She was like apologizing, like, oh, sorry for my kid. To light, like really light coming in her eyes and being like, oh, this is wonderful. Like that encouragement of this thing that we did. And then her older kids started talking to me about a book that she made. So it is really lovely, like, even if you're a grown-up who doesn't have time to sit down and make the Play-Doh and do the thing, like, even supplying some materials and seeing what your kid can come up with is, like, that's joyful.
Yeah,
that's
joyful.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I was just going to ask about the kids in the film and, like, how did that filmmaking process and thinking through, you know, all of the finding those parts and making everything for the film, like, I'm just wondering if you stayed in touch and, like, if they've seen any, like, ripple effects specifically for them.
Yeah, so the filmmaker and I had been working together. We're friends. We had just finished making a whole YouTube series called Mondays with May. So him and I had gotten into a bit of a rhythm. So when I got asked to make this film, I brought him along. And I originally wanted to use my nieces. I've used them in other film projects before, and they got too shy and embarrassed and backed out last second. So his kids came in and got to be the stars, and they're just regular kids who, they're not like theater kids or showbiz kids. So it was quite difficult, actually. We had to be very strategic about breaking up the activities. We filmed it over 2 days. And just worked really hard to make sure we all looked the same both days, and gave them like short amounts of activities to do and then let them go do their own thing and then would set up everything that needed to be set up and just bring them in really quick to do the next thing. But they're so excited. Right now they're dog sitting my dog, who's also featured, Candy Girl. And so I dropped Candy Girl off last night and told them I was coming and that their film was going to be on this big screen, and they were running around the living room, like screaming and so excited. And we did get to see it together when it was in Brooklyn. So that was really nice. Yeah.
I have a logistics. I mean, maybe it's financial, but where did you get the funding to offer these free plans? Or is it just like your volunteer hours? Did you have like other organizations that you are funding that you're able to utilize to provide that housing and that affordable housing on your, on the house? Pun intended.
Well, so we've helped fundraise, like approach donors to donate. And then our personal time and energy that we've donated, probably just bad business sense for the most part. I've never seen an armored car full of money following a hearse to the cemetery. So, you know, just did it and worried about it later.
Yeah, I'm curious about money as well in the affordable housing. Like we had big fires in Eugene, and we looked at the prices of like building sustainably, getting solar and stuff, and it was just like way more expensive to do that, and so ultimately didn't. And so I'm curious what you're seeing, like, or like kind of a little bit more about what it means to build all these affordable housing units, and like whether it's starting to be more competitive when you're doing it at a larger scale, and just any comments you have on that.
Yeah, so it depends on where, right? So the piece of property is 10 acres, and it's former cane fields. So the property was leased to Family Life Center for $1, and said, do something. The mayor gave permission, said, just go, just do something. And when we looked at the actual cost, and we've been involved with other projects related to temporary housing with FEMA. And for example, with FEMA, we would provide one, say, two-bedroom unit for about $500,000. That was the cost of just that unit. And then an infrastructure cost on top of that of about $200,000 to $300,000. Okay, so a lot of that infrastructure is cables, transformers, trenching, conduit, pull boxes, load centers, all this distribution for the infrastructure, which infrastructure is a huge issue with housing. That's one of the main ones. So what we were able to show is that through the generosity of the renewable energy industry, We were able to get reduced rates on old equipment, models that have been discontinued. So we have had just about 1 megawatt of solar panels donated free of charge. Okay, so, and then when we're talking about a nonprofit, there's different types of expenses, and say I'm a bad business person, but I try my best. There's two things. There's capital investment and there's operating costs. So if you're a nonprofit and you don't have like steady income streams, then operating income is huge, right? So if we can make it where for 200 people, we have about 83 households. The average household probably spends about $300 to $400 a month on electricity in Hawaii because we spend about three times what you spend on electricity because of our remoteness. So just that right there is a car payment for a cheap car to get to work. So it just depends on how you look at it, right? So I can tell you from experience, we've worked on other homeless projects that are similar. This project all in, as no federal funding, no government funding, it's about $19 million. That same dollar amount we noticed for a small homeless village that we did for the state of Hawaii, under state of Hawaii terms and conditions, was about three times that cost. So, it's all relative.
You're going to have to get it donated if you want those solar panels. David knows a guy. I am wondering what led you to do this work. I mean, what inspired you? Yes, the film, Make It Myself, there's a lot of inspiration in that, but what is inspiring you to put that message out or collaborate with the band or, yeah.
So most of the work I do is with or for children, and I really care about kids. I've like jokingly said that I really do believe that children are the future, just like the song says. and so I think, kids' minds are still growing and little sponges, so the messages that we put out to them are so important, and I'm really, really careful about, and Anne's on a log too, like with each word of a lyric, like with, are we going to say or, but, or if, like each one has a really different meaning. We have to be really specific here. Really, really care about the messages that are being sent out to kids. And so working on sending out positive messages. So all the work I do is socially conscious, eco-conscious work. I do mostly theater. Video is in there a lot, film. I've written a book. I have an educational series online. Like, everything is all kind of interconnected, and it's all promoting curiosity, positivity, body positivity, and, like, eco-conscious and social consciousness.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
I like that. Any questions? Any more questions? Because I can keep them coming. So this is what I was thinking, because we're going to do our panel. I wanted to find the common ground here. So maybe it's not the same exact thing, but I'm wondering if we can share or speak to what was that moment in your life that you knew it led you here and here and here into the next thing, into being in a film festival and to participating in filmmaking. What was that one moment, whether it was like all of my whole childhood or just an aha moment where you knew, like, kind of entering in the world of environmentalism was going to be your path? I know that's kind of a deep question, but who wants to go first?
Well, there's something that you said that I was like, oh, I hear a connection. you talked about FEMA, and when I was a teenager, I started clowning. And I was a clown, and I wasn't very good at it. So I was like doing a monthly outreach, and 1 month I was a clown. Everyone wanted to talk to me and do stuff, and I was like, oh, no, I don't want to talk to anyone. The next month I was a mime. Then everyone wanted to pantomime to me, and I was like, oh, no, I can't, I don't know. So then I went back to being a clown, and I just worked on my skills. And eventually another group came and scooped me up and was like, hey, we're doing like disaster relief work. Do you want to come with us? And I ended up working alongside FEMA groups to devastated areas as a clown. I got much better at clowning over the many years. But that was like kind of my pathway into the arts was this, like, oh, how can I contribute to this community event? I'll slap on some face paint and hand out balloons. And then, like, my whole path is kind of, like, stayed along the side, but, you know, really expanded. So it really did kind of start with disaster relief, too.
I would say that my main motivation has probably been just my love and appreciation for the environment. So I grew up in East Texas in an oil field. And I saw the devastation where I grew up, like camping and playing in the forest with my siblings. It's now a strip mine, a coal strip mine, and I've watched that happen over the course of my life. And then the opportunity to go to Alaska when I was in college and see how beautiful that was and to sort of get out of my sort of immediate surroundings. In 2001, my brother and I were on a fishing boat. He had just graduated high school. I brought him up to Alaska. And we hit an iceberg, basically the same place that the Exxon Valdez ran aground trying to avoid icebergs. 20 years later, we went back to Alaska and kind of just as a little memorial and get together again. And we went to go see the Columbia Glacier, which is where the ice came that the Exxon Valdez tried to detour around and hit Bly Reef and created the worst oil spill at the time in United States history. The same icebergs that we hit like 20-something years later. And we rented a boat, and we're going to go out Prince William Sound for 5 days. And I thought I was having dementia because I'm like, okay, we're going to round Cole Ross Point, and we're going to see Columbia Glacier. Okay, we're going to round Cole Ross Point. There's Cole Ross Point. We're going to see the glacier. Or maybe it's just a little bit further. I forgot. It used to be a tidal water glacier, and it started retreating in 2001, which is the year that we sank our boat. And by 2021, it has receded over 12 miles inland. It's no longer a tidal water glacier, and it's lost 16 gigatons of ice, and it's probably it could be totally gone now. So that's something that's happened in my lifetime, and so as an architect. You know, about 40% of the carbon emissions in the United States today, and it's represented for the world too, come from buildings operating. About 10 to 11% is construction materials, like concrete, it's a huge one. And then about another 20% for like transportation for just regular people. And as an urban planner as well, that means that I potentially have the ability to shape and mold 50% of our carbon that's released every day into our atmosphere collectively, regardless of country or state or political affiliation. We're all breathing the same air and seeing effects from a changing climate and changing atmosphere. So for me, it's just like, you know, that's the one thing that brings us together, and we can all focus on that, whether we think that climate change is because of what we do or it's just happening. We should do something about it. We should think about how we build. It's going to affect the most vulnerable the most. And we have a responsibility, if we can, to do something about it. So the longer that we put that off, you know, that's on us. So if I can inspire someone to do it, and I can show people, hey, we're actually doing this, and we're doing it, and we're making money at it. Our architecture firm is also design build, and we design and install our own energy systems. So we have a completely different business model. We built electric cars for our clients to match their houses and interface with their electric systems. So we look for different profit models and ways to do things. And really, we just hope that we can inspire people to copy what we're doing or do something better. And yeah, so that's my inspiration.
I love that.
Are your plans available for purchase if somebody wanted to try and build one here or build something? I mean, or do you want to be in charge of the process all the way around?
I guess what I would say is this, is that architecture, and we've seen it through history before we were able to move around with planes and trains and automobiles so quickly, architecture should be vernacular and it should be place-based, both environmentally and community-based, as well as the materials. So what we do in Hawaii, per se, isn't necessarily applicable right here, just like what people do in the Mediterranean isn't applicable, but we do work outside of Hawaii. So we would love to continue to do what we do this is a more challenging environment to work in, and so we love a challenge. So we would love to see where we can make that happen. We have worked on a disaster relief housing that's more universal with the U.S. Forest Service using mass timber, and we're about to build the first one in Lahaina. It's going to be the Habitat for Humanity Maui Chapter's bunkhouse. So if you ever want to come to Lahaina and volunteer for a week, you can stay in the mass timber bunkhouse and help us rebuild. So yes, we would love to help. I don't think that necessarily just having a set of plans, I think that's part of the problem that we have, is we think that we can just pick a house out of a catalog and put it in a certain place and then pump a bunch of electricity and gas into it and make it work.
Right.
When we should be thinking about it differently. How can we make the building work and use as little energy inputs as possible using nature and the things around us to teach us and show us how to do it? So, but yes, we'd love to help.
Have you found ways to like use some of the things you've discovered, like the uses of energy and like in Hawaii, like put them on pre-existing buildings, like kind of retrofit them to kind of help not just like buildings that are already there, not just new construction?
Yeah, definitely. We've been working on something for a couple of years. I have to thank my friend Matt that's here today for turning me on to this 20-something years ago. But
thanks, Matt.
Our office is in an old pineapple cannery. So it has been repurposed, and it's now an architecture office. And now we have a 4,500-square-foot facility where we're producing insulated composite concrete forms that we collect from the surfboard shapers and manufacturers in our building that they were throwing in the dumpster. And I was like, we can't just keep throwing this in the landfill. So we created a Surf Block Maui. And so we're doing that. And now we're working on sheet materials. So we're basically taking that foam, we're grinding it up, and we're recasting it. And we're making panels that then we can apply to existing homes to increase the insulation value, the R value, and then also make them more fire resistant. Yes, we're working on things like that. But it is much easier to do it from a blank slate.
Yeah.
But it's not impossible. But when we do work on existing buildings, it's really hard. So that's why we kind of, our little mandate for our clients to be net zero, we have it on new buildings because it's much easier to achieve if we can start from the beginning.
Okay, one last thing. So just to personalize it, what's one fun fact about yourself? And then we'll start the panel. I think that's important. Connection matters.
Well, I've revealed that I'm a clown.
You have to pick another fun fact. That's boring right now. We already know.
Let's see. Okay, so I have a theater company called Stemmersive, and we put on live plays inside of an inflatable planetarium dome. That's pretty fun.
Yeah,
that's a fun fact. Yeah, it's like 25 feet, but it shrinks down to like this big. And it just sits in my storage unit when we're not doing shows. But yeah, that's fun. It's exciting.
Gosh, I can't follow that. People usually don't know, but I have a little farm. And I have cows that we have named when they're born on the Hawaiian moon face. So that's super cute. Little calves are cute. And but besides work and farming little calves and sheep, I don't do too much.
You do the most. Okay, well, let's give them a round of applause and then we'll get this. If anyone needs to skedaddle before the panel, do not forget to do that postcard, because we need a cleaner Lane County. So everyone needs a cleaner everywhere.
Absolutely.
Thank you, guys.
Absolutely. I'm just going to say something real quick.
I just would love for everyone to take a 5-minute intermission so you have a chance to stretch your legs, get some concessions, and say hi to our filmmakers. Can we do one more round of applause? Thank you for joining us. Okay, so we'll be back here in just 5 short minutes. All right, my name is Beth, and I work at Bring. I started here about a year and a half ago when I heard this panel back in 2023. Emily from Bring talked about rethink business, and I thought, Dang, that's cool. I've been working in community mental health for about 10, 15 years, and I was really excited to do something different. And I'm finding that I'm using my mental health skills talking to businesses. Because they are going through a lot. They go through a lot every day trying to figure out how to take care of their customers and their employees and then somehow make a profit. One of the things that Rethink Business has been doing since 2010 is supporting businesses to take the next sustainable step. We want to recognize their efforts for what they're already doing, and we want to help them make the next change they can. So we have some Rethink certification that we can do. Hey, welcome, join us. We also provide K-12 education to on waste in Lane County, and we partner closely with Lane County Waste Management. I'm very proud to work for Brain. So over the last year and a half, I started working on food and beverage manufacturing, helping them learn how to understand what their equipment can do and what it can do better. And I have learned as I've gone, and every single business owner taught me something really important that I shared with someone else. And early on in the process, we understood the impact of refrigerants and managing refrigerants to make sure that they just save really good money on their equipment by making sure that it lasts a long time, and the value of maintenance, and then the value of changing the refrigerants down from high global warming potential refrigerants down to lower ones. So this has now become my own passion project, and we're trying to figure out how to make it much more accessible to everyone else. So you all can do this when you go home, if you'd like. Make sure your refrigerator coils are nice and clean. Ideally, you'd be cleaning them every 3 months. Your refrigerator will last longer. It will also operate much more efficiently, which will save you money, and it'll make it less likely that any refrigerant will leak out of there. Because when the refrigerant gets up into the atmosphere, it can hold a lot more heat in. And so we just want to make sure that you guys hang on to your refrigerators as long as you can, and then change your filters and your HVAC quarterly. So that's my little PSA for tonight. I'm going to pass it down.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Jeff Orlandini. I run the Waste Management Division for Lane County Public Works. And I think, you know, a couple things that I like to make sure people know is, A, is the county, we don't get to tell all the cities what to do, you know, because there's the home rule charter. So a lot of people call us, something happened in my cart in Springfield, and, you know, we don't really manage that. But we basically manage all of the transfer stations, including the Glenwood Transfer Station, all the way over to Florence and Oak Ridge and Mackenzie Bridge. So all those places that people can go take the materials that they no longer have a use for, they bring to us. We also manage the Short Mount Landfill. It's a relatively unique situation where a local government owns and operates a landfill. Most, overwhelming majority of your landfills are run by private companies, kind of the big three. And so it puts us in a unique position where, you know, we're not just profit-driven, right? We're also, you know, especially now, driven by some of the, you know, climate and trying to reduce, you know, our climate footprint, especially with landfills being the largest emitters of greenhouse gases, you know, doing everything we can do to mitigate that, even sometimes at, you know, the cost of, you know, profit, if you will. So I came from a nonprofit background. That's where I came up working in nonprofits. And so moving to local government did not feel that odd to me because you're still serving your community and trying to do what you can do to better your community. So it feels really good to be able to do that. The other thing I want to touch on, we're doing a lot of policy work now in our division, really trying to think about materials that usually come our way and how we can best manage those. And, you know, most of the time I think we think that's, you know, getting them out of the landfill if we can, reusing them, and also focusing on reduction as well. But a lot of those have been like the mattress policy, you know, where folks can now recycle mattresses. We're really working hard on batteries right now, trying to figure out how to get all those lithium-ion batteries out of the landfills and causing those fires. One thing that we also are trying to focus on is most people, what's interesting about today and the films that I saw on your agenda is that, you know, most people don't think about end of life when they make the new neat thing, you know? So EVs came out, they're really fantastic, and then people start saying, where do I take my battery from my Leaf? You know, we're like, nobody thought about that, and we're reacting a lot, and we don't like to be in that reaction mode because it usually takes years to find that solution, and so then you have that interim. And so we're really trying to figure out how we can get people to think about when we're making the new thing, how are we going to manage that when it's no longer, you know, its useful life has been run out. So Want to highlight that, and obviously Steve's going to talk a lot about his company, and you know, we're talking a lot about doing this thing called Clean Lane, right? And really trying to reduce the amount of materials going to landfill, pulling out that gas from organic material before it enters that landfill environment. There's a lot of fugitive emissions that you just can't avoid when you landfill organics. So even if you have the best gas extraction systems after it's been placed in the landfill, you're looking at, you know, maybe 70 to 80% of that capturable gas able to be captured. And that's after fugitive emissions. What we're looking to do is saying before those organics hit the landfill, let's process that and pull the gas out closer to a 95 to 98% capture rate, right? And so taking that and looking at it more as a resource as opposed to either putting the landfill and pulling it out or, you know, burning it off, right, to make it less harmful, but let's make it a resource. So really excited about the potential for that. I know there's some postcards that you can help kind of advocate for that and make sure the commissioners know that it's something that you would support if you do indeed. So pass it on to Steve.
Great, thank you. Happy to be here. A little bit about our company. We build systems that process various types of waste. Our main goal in all of the systems that we do is to identify elements and take each thing to its highest and best use. Sometimes that's extracting plastic to make new plastic, paper to make a new box, organics to take the energy content from it, and in this case, produce a biogas to make a transportation fuel. We've recently determined we can take the CO2, which commonly in these systems go to atmosphere, but we can capture that as well, liquefy it, and then use that to replace for industrial gas uses. We do this sort of thing all over the world. We tend to be technology forward. So a lot of the things that are now being done in our world of managing waste, we were really an innovator. First company, for example, to take organic waste, produce a biogas, but then use that gas to as a transportation fuel. And so we were just sort of interested in the idea of, well, you know, what happens if the truck that picks up your waste is fueled by the waste collected. And just the circularity of that, we always thought was interesting, and we were able to put that into place in a project that we built in San Francisco in 2017. Some of the batteries that you're talking about, we're actually working on that now. We just signed a development agreement with a company. One of the things that, you know, we all know is when you have your cell phone, it's got a lithium-ion battery, so does your computer, so does pretty much now so many of the products that we have. When they go into the landfill, the waste environment, and there's any kind of compression, they combust. Those combustion then creates a fire event, really a problem. When you speak of fires at the landfill, how many do you see?
Dozens at the landfill, the transfer stations, yeah.
Very common. There was a very large landfill recently in Los Angeles area called Chiquita Canyon, actually operated by owned by Waste Connections, the company that owns Sanipac. They've had fires inside the landfill now going on for years, producing toxic gases. They just shut the landfill at the end of last year. 7,000 ton per day facility. Now all of that material goes somewhere else, but they just can't control it. And, you know, these are things that, you know, once you lose control of it, then you lose the ability to really do that thing that I described, which is to take this material to its highest and best use. And so having it come into one place, you saw, for those of you who were there today, you saw that we use a lot of technology, AI, spectral imaging, screening, density separation, anaerobic digestion to capture that biogas. And we do all of these things at scale in a continuous process. And that's really what's required to create something that's beneficial. And at the end of the day, there's a value set there. People talk about cost of an operation like this, and then we covered some of those costs today. There is a cost to do it. There's no question about it. You then, though, have to consider the cost of not doing it. What are the costs of environmental events? I just read this last year we've spent in the U.S., there's been $100 billion spend dealing with floods, fires, the various catastrophes that come from climate. So these issues don't really go away, and the cost doesn't go away. What we're doing here locally, of course, is trying to get ahead of it, which I will tell you is a very forward thinking process. We actually have a county here in Lane County that developed a strategic plan. They then developed a climate action plan. The county is simply implementing that plan. What a unique approach. Think about the various plans that people spend hours, days, weeks, months, years developing. And what do? They go on a shelf and nobody does anything with it. Here you have a situation where they're implementing. They're actually doing it. And really something, I think, to be applauded. With the work we do this around the world. And so we have systems in virtually every continent. I don't think we have anything in Antarctica. Otherwise, we're pretty much all over the place dealing with the different types of waste. When you, some of our projects that we're working on now, the film on Africa resonated. We're actually working on a project now with a company in Africa. This is in, it's a Ghanaian company. And we're working on something in Lagos, Nigeria, where they have 7,000 tons per day of trash that gets dumped. It's not landfilled. That's too precious of a word. It simply gets dumped in fields. Leachate goes into the groundwater. It is highly spoiling. It isn't just the methane that spoils their environment, but rather groundwater that, or the leachate that gets into the groundwater, gets consumed. And this really happens all over the place. You see it commonly in South America. You see it throughout Asia, Africa. We enjoy here this, you know, unique process where we, here in the States, we put something in a bin, we roll it out every week, somebody comes and gets it. That's not the case in most of the world. And so these are things that, though, that there's a tremendous amount of recognition. Happily, with some of the technologies that we have, we're able to participate in it. And so it's a unique time around it. A lot of recognition of the value set. And I think, really, when you bring it into this local situation, it's just, you really can't help but complimenting the people here who are putting this into action, and of course we're very happy to be part of it. So, thank you.
Who are you? I'm sorry. Who are you?
We missed that part. Right.
Did I? Sorry about that. Steve Miller. I'm the CEO at Bulk Handling Systems.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Get so excited.
Hi, my name's Mason. Mason Levitt. I work at Beyond Toxics. We're a local nonprofit based here in Eugene, Oregon. Over the last 3 years, I have had the pleasure of working with residents in and around Coffin Butte Landfill, and they are facing many of the environmental consequences that we just discussed, whether it's through landfill gas escaping the operation there and causing new local odor problems and nuisance concerns over people being able to use their homes or go outside or feel safe doing so, or whether it's related to the climate damage that is caused by that. There's been a lot of concerns around landfill fires and leachate and a lot of the problems that we're kind of getting into here. And there has just not been the same implementation of these types of policies that we've just discussed over the past few minutes. So I've had the opportunity to work with this group, and we have been, you know, getting together weekly and figuring out how do we move this one step forward at a time at Benton County, and then, you know, across the state of Oregon, hopefully eventually, right? It's all about focusing on local and then being able to scale that up at a later point. So I'm here today to share a little bit about that, but then also, you know, really highlight the work that's being done here at a local scale to really implement those solutions and focus on those solutions.
Are you listening to the Eugene Environmental Film Festival on from members of the panel of Brings Recycling? So I hope you'll support independent media, because you're not going to hear stuff like this on anywhere else but community, local community radio. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends, support independent media. And yeah, I'm starting to say check out the open mics. Oh, and also shout out to radioforall.net. All of my shows are archived on radioforall.net from almost 30 years of shows, where that was started by the, it's what the last of the independent media center that was started during the Battle of Seattle. So I hope you'll support radioforall.net. That's radio with the number 4, ALL.net. Thanks for listening. Support independent media. If I haven't said that already, support independent media. Tune in for part 2 of the Brings panel at the Eugene Environmental Film Festival of October 25, 2025, next week.
Like tears from the sky.